This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Midrash says, on Vayikach Shem V'yefes es Hasimlo, you remember Ham saw his father Noach after he had drunk and he wasn't properly clothed, and he went and told his brothers. And then it says that Shem and Yefes took clothing and they walked backwards towards their father and covered him. But it doesn't say Vayikhu Shem V'yefes es Hasimlo, it doesn't say and Shem V'yefes took in the plural, but Vayikach Shem V'yefes es Hasimlo, and he took Shem V'yefes the clothing. Omer Rabbi Yochanan, so Rabbi Yochanan says, Shem hischil b'mitzvah tchila. The mitzvah is attributed to Shem more than to Yefes. Although they both participated in the mitzvah, the mitzvah is attributed to one of them, and it's to Shem. Why? Because hitchil b'mitzvah tchila. He started the mitzvah. He was the one who set it in motion. Uvo Yefes v'nishmaloi. And Yefes then came and joined in. Lefichach, therefore, zocho Shem letalis. Shem merited the mitzvah of tzitzis. The Yefes lefivlo, and Yefes got beautiful clothing. Yefes was the forerunner of Greek civilization and culture. Those who appreciated classical beauty, aesthetics, fine clothing, that was Yefes. And that beauty in the presentation of things in which Yefes excels, the ability to present things, to dress up, to dress themselves up and to dress everything around them up in beautiful form, that is as a result, that was Bischus Yefes' participation in the mitzvah of Kibud Av, as expressed in the covering up of their father's nakedness. Shem gets the mitzvah of tzitzis instead. Shem, who started the mitzvah, he gets the mitzvah of tzitzis. What does the Midrash mean? What is so important about the beginning of this mitzvah? Why does Shem get the mitzvah of tzitzis for it, and Yefes gets the aesthetic clothing for it? But we need to understand a little bit about what Shem and Yefes are, and we need to understand a little bit about what the mitzvah of tzitzis is. The Torah says, and we say it twice every day, V'hoyolochem letzitzis, and it shall be for you as tzitzis, u'isem oisoi, and you shall see them, you shall see the tzitzis, u'zachartem eskol mitzvahis Hashem, and you will remember all the mitzvahs of the Ribbono Shel Olam, va'asisem oisom, and you will do them. So the mitzvah of tzitzis is a mechanism for becoming aware or retaining an awareness of all the mitzvahs of the Ribbono Shel Olam and doing them, bringing one to the action. How does this work? How are we going to remember the mitzvahs? Says Rashi, Sheminyan gematria shel tzitzis sheshmeus. Because if you add up the number of letters in the word tzitzis, it comes to 600. The tof is 400, and the two tzadis are 90 each, that's another 180, and the two yuds are another 20, that makes 600. Ushmoine chutin, and the 8 threads, the chamisho kshorim, and the 5 knots. That's what tzitzis is. It's the words, the letters that constitute the word tzitzis. It's the 8 threads and the 5 knots. So if you add up 608 and 5, you come to 613. That's how you remember the 613 mitzvahs. And that brings you to do it. Strange, Rashi. Because Lamaisa, we don't go through that mental process every time we see the tzitzis. Go through working out what the word tzitzis is and what it works out in gematria and the 8 threads and the 5 knots. What does it mean? But here we have the essence of how we approach our physical environment. Let's go back to the Midrash and then we'll analyze that Rashi in more detail. Shem hitchil b'mitzvah tchilo. He started the mitzvah. Vo yefes v'nishma lo, and yefes came and he responded to it. He joined in. So yefes gets the beautiful clothing, he gets aesthetics, and Shem gets mitzvahs. What's the difference? What's the essence of aesthetics and what's the essence of the mitzvahs? Yefes, Hirsch discusses the word yefes, and he relates it to two concepts. The one is yofe, beauty, aesthetics. And the other is a word that we've had very often in our Mishle Shir of Shabbos afternoon that the Vilna Gaon makes a lot of, and that's the word pesi. Pei sof yud, pesi. It's a simple person, as it's normally translated. But the Vilna Gaon has explained when we've had it that pesi means somebody who is easily influenced. Somebody naive. Somebody who doesn't have a strong viewpoint and is easily affected by his environment. And Hirsch connects the two concepts up, aesthetics and pesi, this naivety. Because the aesthetics is, or yefes, represents that type of person who is easily influenced by his environment. The beauty of his environment affects him. He responds to beauty in the environment. So that's a maila and it's a chisorin. That's an advantage and a disadvantage. It's very nice to respond to beauty. And Hirsch makes the point that these three sons were all saved with Noach, Shem, Ham, and Yofes, which means that the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to preserve each of these three qualities in the post-flood humanity. Otherwise, he could have done away with one of them or with two of them if he only wanted to preserve Shem as he was. But that the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted a synthesis of all these three qualities in the post-flood humanity, all subjected to the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So none of them are inherently negative. They can become negative if they're not used correctly. And Yefes's ability to respond to beauty is in itself positive. The only problem is it can lead to pesi. If it's on its own, if there is no other internal drive, if he only responds to the external, if he only responds to beauty, and he cannot create beauty himself, that's where it can become negative, because he's then completely in the hands of his environment, and he's a function of his environment. He's affected by his environment, he's controlled by his environment, he reacts instead of acts. He responds instead of creates. Yefes, that's the essence of Yefes. Aesthetics, both on the positive side in its response to beauty, and the danger of the negative side in that it responds, or he responds, only to beauty in the object, beauty in the external. Shame means a name, a concept, a term. And the essence of shame, says Hirsch, is the ability to define. The ability to take a physical thing and give it an intellectual term, a term which can make it into a concept. I've mentioned to you before that the prevailing view, and I've brought Raya's from Chazal for it also, is there's been discussion for many, many years among the psychologists whether speech is a function of intellect or intellect is a function of speech. Can we think because we can speak? Or do we learn to speak because we know how to think? Do we first make a concept and then look for a word for it? Or is it because we now have to make words that we can think? And I've brought Urias from Chazal and also from life that it's the words which create the thinking ability. In life I've given a simple example of that, and that is the child ceases to cry when the mother leaves it, when the child can say mother, can say mommy. Then the child stops crying when the mother leaves it. Until the child can say mommy, the child cannot conceptualize. And therefore when the mother leaves physically, the child believes that the mother's gone forever. The child cannot continue to relate to the mother in the mother's absence. The moment the child can say mommy, the child has the ability to see the mother as a concept. And even if the physical mother has left the house, the concept mother and the relationship with its mother is retained and remains. And the child can continue existing quite happily after that time. The ability to express a concept enables one to use the concept in one's thinking. And that's why Unkelus says that the spirit of Hashem, that Hashem breathed into mankind, that the creation, he doesn't say was the power of thought, the power of intellect. We would have thought that that's what makes us human, that that's what differentiates us from the animal world, the power of reasoning. But Unkelus doesn't say that, you remember. He says, Ruach Memalala. It's the power of speech which differentiates from the animals. As a consequence of the power of speech, we can think. But the essential difference is our ability to conceptualize, to create a word which expresses a concept, so which expresses a thing, a physical thing. We can take the physical and we can convert it into a conceptual idea. And that's expressed in the name Shem. Shem is that one of the sons who has the ability to take a physical thing and to create an idea out of that physical thing. Now let's look at them in their relationship to this episode with their father. The Greeks, the Ephes, that whole culture, that civilization responds to beauty. And they recoil from ugliness. If something is aesthetically displeasing, they recoil from it. Not necessarily so with shame. Shame has another way of relating. My mother expressed horror today when one of my children brought a Cabbage Patch doll to the table. She said she's never seen anything so ugly. How can the children like them? But the fact is, many people became millionaires out of Cabbage Patch dolls. So whether my mother likes it or not, there's something in them that works, and it wasn't just marketing, because it's the children who chose the Cabbage Patches. It's not just the mothers who bought the Cabbage Patches because of television advertising. The children really adored them more than any other doll. And if you go sometimes to take a child, it's a very interesting experience. There's a toy shop in Hyde Park. Have you seen that sells the most exquisite dolls? Those sort of cost from 1,000 rand up. Exquisite dolls. And if you give a child the choice between one of those exquisite dolls and the Cabbage Patches, they always take the Cabbage Patches. The mothers choose, and the grandmothers choose the exquisite dolls, and the children choose the Cabbage Patches. What was the whole chokhmah of the Cabbage Patch? We've spoken about it before. The creation of imperfection in the doll. The exquisite doll in Hyde Park doesn't need a mommy. It's perfect as it stands. It's put on a mantelpiece, to put in a showcase. There's nothing a little child can do to express its maternal instincts to this perfect doll. If anything, it makes the child feel inadequate. The child takes one look in the mirror and thinks, if I look like my doll, maybe my mother would love me more. That's all that the child can think. But to actually create a relationship with this little piece of perfection, the child can't. The Cabbage Patch comes with such a sad story. Abandoned in the Cabbage Patch, and this, and nobody knows who its mother is, and the poor little Cabbage Patch, and it's so ugly, and nobody likes it, and nobody feels for it. There's a place for the child. The child has the opportunity of doing something. The child sees the Cabbage Patch as an opportunity for the expression of maternity. That's why the child the child loves the Cabbage Patch. And that's why one of the many reasons, that a mother loves its newborn baby. The mother's the only one who thinks that the newborn baby is really beautiful. But that's all that's important. Nobody else has to think it. The mother thinks it, and that's good enough. But why does the mother think that the newborn baby is beautiful? Surely the mother has some kind of aesthetic sense. And the mother, you can have a mother who can go to an art gallery and she can distinguish between what is beautiful and what isn't beautiful. She has a very fine aesthetic sense. And this little monster comes out and she thinks it's beautiful. What's happened to the aesthetic sense? This is a Cabbage Patch. There are two types of aesthetics we've discussed. The Greeks created the formula of objective aesthetic perfection. They created the little dolls in Hyde Park, where the object is absolutely perfect. But there's another kind of aesthetics, and that is what we term as something that has chen. Something that has chen is not something necessarily that's perfect. You can have a woman who conforms to all the requirements, in theory at least, of classical Greek aesthetics and beauty. The proportions are perfect, but she doesn't have chen, there's a coldness. And you can have a woman who's not so perfect, but she has chen. What does that mean? The chen is the ability to create in the other person a feeling of empathy and a feeling of sympathy. Sympathy not in the sense of nebuch, but sympathy and empathy in a feeling of identification. In a situation where the unit becomes perfect, rather than where the object is perfect. We've discussed it before in Shiduchim, where people say, what does he see in her, and what does she see in him? She's so beautiful, and she's so rich, and she's so clever, and he's so poor, and so ugly, and such a nebuch. What kind of a shidduch is it? And we've discussed so often that the creation of a good shidduch is not through a perfect spouse, because a perfect spouse doesn't need the other one. The perfect shidduch is a shidduch where the imperfections of each complement one another, and the perfections of each, the strengths complement each other and the weaknesses complement each other, and the unit creates a cycle of perfection, not that each one is perfect. And so it is when we talk about this chen as opposed to classical beauty, we're talking about an object which creates the opportunity for the development of beauty. where one is able to spot something and say, this is material from which to create beauty. That's very different from saying it as one looks at something, this is something which is beautiful. A completely different approach. Shame has the ability to create beauty out of imperfection. Shame has the ability to take a situation or an object which in itself is not beautiful, and by relating it to it correctly in the way which we're going to discuss in a moment, to create perfection out of imperfection. That's what shame can do. Using his power of shame, his power of conceptualizing, he's able to create beauty out of imperfection. And so shame sees an ugly sight. He sees his father, Noach, Tzaddik, who's just gone through the experience of the Mabul, the flood, and the Teva, and he sees him rolling, drunk, compromised, unclothed, an ugly sight. Ham took pleasure in the sight. It's a different story altogether. Yefes doesn't know how to relate to it. Yefes can't relate to that. It's ugliness. And he would, on his own, not have done anything. He would have ignored it. Shame sees this as an opportunity to create perfection out of imperfection. What is the perfection? The mice of the action. Shame then takes the clothing and in a most sensitive and beautiful way covers the father so that the scene becomes a scene of beauty. The scene becomes a scene of perfection. If one were then, if you could imagine seeing that scene on the stage, Noach in his embarrassment, Noach in his disgrace, having been still further disgraced by Ham, yet standing in the background not knowing what to do, and shame taking the initiative and joining Yefes in and sensitively walking backwards so that they don't see their father and their father doesn't feel further humiliated, covering their father up in a way that his dignity is restored, that scene becomes one of perfection, becomes one of beauty. And it's to that scene which Yefes can relate. When shame starts the mitzvah, Yefes can come in. He can't start because he's dealing with ugliness. And Yefes doesn't know how to handle ugliness. But the moment shame picks up the clothing and starts walking backwards towards his father, Yefes already sees the whole scene. And he sees his brother covering his father. No longer does he see the naked father, the drunken naked father. That's not what he sees anymore. Now he sees the dedicated son and the pathetic father relating to one another in a most beautifully sensitive way. To that Yefes can relate and he joins him. And so Yefes gets as a result of that the pivlo, he gets as a result of that the beautiful clothing. The object that is in itself beautiful. When you look at the Greek clothed in his majesty and his dignity, one is impressed with the aesthetics of it. Because that is what Yefes had, that is what Yefes developed, that was the midah of Yefes. But shame gets the mitzvah of tzitzis. Let's now go back to the Rashi on the mitzvah of tzitzis. Says Rashi, was a chayotim, was called mitzvah is Hashem. How do you remember all the mitzvahs of Hashem? By a combination of the gematria of the word tzitzis and the 8 threads and the 5 knots. What are we doing here? We're taking the shame, we're taking the concept, tzitzis. We're not just looking at the object. If you look at the object alone, what do you see? A few threads. 8 threads and 5 knots. What does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. But if you look at the name alone, it also doesn't mean anything. The concept alone is also not meaningful. 600, what is it? The word tzitzis, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything, it's a term. Tzitzis is a term which has no inherent meaning. But when you take the term tzitzis, and you take the physical object together, and you synthesize the physical appearance of the object with the concept that lies behind the concept, with the concept that lies behind the object, what do you land up with? You say, what is tzitzis? You say, tzitzis is composed of 2 major parts. A concept called tzitzis and a physical thing which is 8 threads and 5 knots. Let's put it all together. The concept tzitzis. It's a word which doesn't mean anything, but when you look at it, it's also numbers. 600. 600, if we're thinking along numbers, then what is tzitzis? 8 threads and 5 knots, that's 613. There one sees the Torah. There one understands tzitzis doesn't just mean that you remember the mitzvahs of Hashem. But tzitzis means you remember how to operate in accordance with the mitzvahs of Hashem. That the method of operation is to look at the world around you and to look at the concept that lies embedded within the world around you, to synthesize the physical with the intellectual, with the spiritual, and to see in the two together the absolute reality. Whereas Yefes relates only to the physical. There must be beauty in the physical, and if there's no beauty in the physical, he's lost. Yefes can also relate, by the way, to beauty in the concept. And that's why the Greeks were able to produce works of art and works of philosophy and mathematics. It didn't have to be physical. The object could be a concept. But there had to be an object that was beautiful and an object that was perfect. To create perfection out of synthesizing concept with object, that wasn't Yefes' field. That was the field of Shem. To be able to see the concept expressed in the object, to synthesize the two, put them together and see the integrity, the totality of the Torah within that. That's something that Shem was able to do. That's what it means when it says that Shem got the mitzvah of tzitzis. Shem got the method, got the principle, got the system of tzitzis. Not just the mitzvah in the simple sense. The Mizrahi asks a kasha on this medrash. He asks that further on, when Avrom HaMelech, you'll remember, when Avrom goes out with the fight with the kings and he saves the king of Sodom, and he's offered all sorts of gifts, Avrom says, I'll take nothing, not a thread from you, not a strap for a shoe, nothing at all. And Gemara says in Soto, on that, bischus Avrom saying, I want nothing at all from you, not even a thread, not a strap, absolutely nothing. His children had the schus of the mitzvah of tcheles, at tzitzis, and the mitzvah of tefillin. So the Mizrahi asks, where does it come from? Does it come from the children of Shem, or does it come from Shem's action here, or does it come from Avrom's action further on? And he answers it, but we don't need to go into his answer, because in effect we see in Avrom's statement a further expression of the Shem principle, a further development of the principle of Shem in our Sedra here. We've often talked about a person's need for recognition, his need for response, his need for feedback. And that's what the king of Sodom is offering. You've done me a tova, you've saved me, I want to respond, I want to give you something for that. He says, Avrom Avinu, I don't need or want anything at all from you, and I will not take anything from you at all. What is Avrom saying? Avrom is saying, I am totally independent of material feedback. I don't need it. I didn't do it for the material side of it, and I don't need the feedback from the material side of it. Yefes is dependent on physical feedback. Totally dependent on physical feedback. If he doesn't find beauty in his environment, he has nothing with which to operate. Avrom is independent. Avrom is able to operate with spiritual input independent of his environment. Let us go back a moment to last week's shiur, where we talked about Bereshis, that the Ribono Shel Olam created the world with Reshis. What does it mean with Reshis? The Medrash said last week, Ve'en Reshis El HaTorah. We talked about the starting off, how one has to begin something with a concept. There we've got Shem again, the same system. Reshis means the beginning, and we discussed that Reshis has the root of the word Reshis is Rosh. And we discussed that the beginning has to be something which exists in concept, something which is intact in concept, a structure which operates in concept. That has to be there before one starts putting anything into practice. The concept has to exist. That's the area of expertise of Shem. The ability to conceptualize, the ability to see something in concept and to express from concept into the physical reality, that direction rather than the other way around. The Reshis, that concept of Reshis which we discussed last week, means to take the concept in its purity and to try to apply it to the physical world in its impurity. We've discussed often that the Torah in itself constitutes an absolutely perfect system. We've discussed also often the nature of a mitzvah derabbanan. The rabbanan come along and the rabbanan adapt the Torah in a sense. A new gezeirah, a new takono. We find the development of the Torah through the halachas of the rabbanan. And there are many dimensions in which one has to understand that evolution of Torah, that development of Torah. But one of the simple things that one has to appreciate is that the Torah as it exists without the laws of the Rabbonin is impractical. As perfect as it is, it doesn't operate in a world that isn't perfect. And we'll find in each of the takonas of the Chazal, each of the gezeiras of the Chazal, are an accommodation of the imperfection of the world, not in any way watering down the Torah, chas v'shalom, but on the contrary, making the Torah practicable even in an imperfect world. Making a perfect system practicable, even in an imperfect world. And one can take it on any level. You can take any mitzvah de rabbanon, and you'll see that operating. The mitzvah de raisa is the issue de raisa on Shabbos, we're not allowed to write. Good. So that's part of the perfect system of the Torah, the perfect system of Hilchos Shabbos, is that if one isn't permitted to write two letters, and if one writes two letters, it's an issue de raisa, it's an issue skila. Come the Chazal, and they say you can't even move a pen. Why do they need to say that? Why isn't it enough just to say, we know what isn't allowed, you're not allowed to write two letters, that's it. Why do the Chazal have to add to that? Not even allowed to move a pen, a takona, a siag. Because of the imperfection of humanity. If we were perfect, it would be sufficient to tell us exactly what the Torah wants from us, and we would abide by that perfectly. But since we're not perfect, since we sometimes forget, since we sometimes get carried away, our minds get distracted, we've got a pen in our hands, and in a moment of forgetfulness or of distraction, we might find ourselves writing. That's an element of our own imperfection. And in order to make the perfect system of the Torah practicable in an imperfect environment, Chazal have to say, not even to touch a pencil, not even to move a pencil. That we can't do either. If we allow ourselves to move a pencil, we will find ourselves unable to fully carry out the perfection of the mitzvah, of the Torah, of the issur of the Torah, which is not to write at all. And so one can go through all the mitzvahs of the Chazal, and one finds they are all there to make the perfection of the Torah practical and workable in an imperfect society, in an imperfect environment. And so it is in all that we do. The reishis has to be the concept, because the concept can be pure. When one's learning a concept, there is no need for any kind of accommodation. When one's learning a concept, there is no need for any kind of concession to imperfection. The concessions to imperfection only have to come when one's applying it in the real world. There it becomes a little more difficult. And that's why there are really two disciplines in the learning. The one is the learning, the lomdus, and the other is the paskening of a halacha. The learning, the lomdus, doesn't need that facility to be able to take into account the imperfection of society in order to paskin. That's the difference of the two roles in learning that we've discussed previously, the role of the Rosh Yeshiva, the Lamdan, and the role of the Rov. The Rosh Yeshiva can afford himself the luxury of operating in a world of perfection. There needs to be absolutely no concession made to any kind of material world in which to operate, because he's operating in the world of the concepts, and in the world of the concepts there is perfection. And that is how we elevate ourselves in the process of learning. To be able to take ourselves off the streets of imperfection and for a couple of hours to sit down in the Beis HaMedrash and apply our minds to a piece of Gemara where we're dealing with perfection is an incredible piece of self-elevation, of removing ourselves from the day-to-day need to constantly juggle and fit things in and operate, and find ourselves in a world where we don't need to do that at all. Where we can apply our minds to purity, to tahara, to kedusha, without any need for accommodation. But then we come back to the real world, and we have to make that halacha operate in the real world. That's where psak comes in, that's where halacha comes in. The sense of taking those perfect concepts and making them work in human situations which cannot, by definition, which cannot be perfect. Shem hischil ba mitzvah tchilo, he started the mitzvah. What was his starting point? If his starting point were his father's nakedness, then he would react the same as Yefes. Ugly, I don't want to see it. Run away. That's the way one relates to ugliness. But that's not his starting point. His starting point is kibud avein. His starting point is a mitzvah. His starting point is a halacha. So he has a concept in his mind. The concept is kibud avein. Respect, honor, dignity of a parent. He now looks at a situation and he sees an imperfection. What must he do with that? He has the perfection of a concept and the imperfection of a situation. He becomes the Rav. He's no longer the Rosh Yeshiva who's studying the halachas of kibud av va'em, nor is he the Greek secular aesthetic person who is recoiling from horror and from indignity. He now becomes the Rav. He becomes the Talmid Chochem, the Ben Torah. The person has to say, I have here a situation which demands attention. I have a halacha which demands application. How do I put the two together? And out of the perfection of halacha and the imperfection of his father's indignity, he creates a scene of the utmost beauty, a scene of the utmost sensitivity, a scene of the utmost depth to which Yefes is already able to relate as well. Then it becomes beautiful. Then it becomes something into which Yefes can be drawn. In that way, the Ben Torah, the Talmid Chacham, remains independent of his environment. His environment then becomes, independence of an environment doesn't mean that you don't relate to it. Independence doesn't mean isolation. Independence doesn't mean operating in a vacuum. Independence means that the flow of energy is from you to it, not it to you. And when we find shame operating and Avraham Avinu operating from concept to environment, rather from environment to concept, then we're relating to a situation where the individual is independent of his environment. I'm there to perfect my environment, not to be affected by it. I don't need anything from it. I've been put here to put into my environment, to invest in my environment, to improve my environment, to beautify my environment. I haven't been put here to take from my environment. For that, I could have stayed up in the world of the souls. There I had everything that I needed. There is nothing that is more perfect about this world than about the world from which I've come. So I haven't come here because it's a better place to be, because it's a better environment. I've come here because the environment is imperfect, and my role is to perfect it. My role is to improve it. That becomes my relationship with it. The Greek doesn't see it that way. He doesn't believe in an Olam Habo. Yefes, the Greek, sees this as the ultimate imperfection. And he only wants to relate to where he sees perfection and where he sees beauty. The Jew wants to relate even where he sees imperfection. Because in imperfection he finds the challenge and the possibilities and the potential for the creation of perfection. And that is his role and that is his function. So Avraham Avinu says to the king of Sodom, I need nothing from you. I work with concepts. I'm here to invest in you. I'm here to invest in my environment. I'm here to invest in my society, not to take from it. And that's a further expression of this middle which shame first developed in potential that Avraham Avinu brings into actuality. This expression that my world of perfection is the Torah. And that's where I get my fulfillment. And that's where I get my feedback. This world is here primarily for me to invest in. This world is here for me to give and to put into. With that we can understand perhaps a little bit more clearly also the criticism of Noach that we discussed last night in the planting of the vine first. Last night we discussed it along the lines of the difference of a motivation based on his own moods as opposed to a motivation based on the needs of his environment. Tonight we can take it a little differently and we can say it wasn't just a question of mood as far as Noach was concerned. He believed that's what the world needed. In his analysis of the situation of the world, he felt that was the most urgent thing to do, for whatever reason, and there are all sorts of different reasons given as to why Noach felt that the most urgent thing that the world needed at that time was a vine. Where's the flaw? In Noach's analysis of the imperfection of the world and his vision of what needs to be done to perfect it, all that is okay, but it's vayachel, it's secular. It's not based on the expression in the world of the perfection of the Torah. His starting point is not a vision based on the perfect model constructed by the concepts of the Torah, which now need, as far as possible, to be expressed in reality. If that were the case, a vine would not have been the first thing he would have planted. He would have planted other things first. He would have come to the vine afterwards. But in his own analysis, if one leaves the Torah out, then one can reach all sorts of conclusions, and that's the conclusion he reached. But that was vayachel. That was a beginning based not on reishis, a beginning based not on ein reishis ela Torah, where one has to take that system of Torah and say, right, I've got a perfect system of Torah. The Torah has not been damaged by the flood. The Torah was perfect, and the Torah is perfect. The Torah remains exactly as it was. All that I have now is an empty world in which to impose the impression of the Torah. To take those concepts and now make them real and now make them actual. If that would have been the approach, then the vine would not have been the thing which would have been planted first. If one merely analyzes without that, then it's a different story altogether. And we find ourselves in that situation all the time, where we see a situation and we appreciate that there's a need for a response, we need to do something, so we're not even on the yefes level. The yefes level is, if there's something beautiful and perfect, we respond. If it's not beautiful, we ignore it. We're interested only in beauty and in perfection. So let's move away from that. We're not holding there. We respond even if something is imperfect. We feel the need to do something about it. That's the Jew. That's the descendants of Shem and certainly of Avraham Avinu. we feel the need to act, we feel the need to improve, we feel the need to build, to construct and to create. But we've got to decide, what are we going to create? What are we going to construct? How are we going to develop? What is our vision of what our environment should look like, whatever the environment is? Whether we're thinking of our own families, whether we're thinking of our community, whether we're thinking of our society, whether we're thinking of an object that we're building and constructing, whatever it is. We must have a vision in mind as to what we want it to look like when we're finished with it. Is that vision a reflection in practicality, in matter, of the principles of the purity of the Torah? Or is that vision something created out of a mere relationship between ourselves and our environment, void of the input of the Torah? That's where we've got to watch ourselves. That in our creativity, in our building and in our construction, what we're trying to build and develop is a model, is a physical model of that perfection and that purity which is expressed in the concepts of the Torah. So that the flow again is from Reishis. The Reishis, the start is the concept in all its purity and in all its perfection. And our endeavor is to make that workable, to make that operate in the environment in which we find ourselves. And lastly, a third midrash which perhaps we can understand also with these concepts a little bit more clearly, is a very tragic sort of midrash. Here the midrash says, Omer Rabbi Brechia, Choviv Moshe mi Noach. Moshe was more beloved to the Ribbono Shel Olam than Noach was. Now, the midrash could give many reasons. Rabbi Brechia could give many, many reasons for that. The one simple one would be that Noach at his height was called Ish Tzadik, a righteous man, which is a very fine term. Whereas as Moshe Rabbeinu was called Ish HaElokim, which is an even finer term, a more intimate relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Tzadik is one thing, but an Ish HaElokim, a man of God, that connotates more intimacy between the man and the Ribbono Shel Olam. But Rabbi Brechia doesn't satisfy himself with that. He looks at the dynamics of it and he says, Noach, Mishe Nikro Ish Tzadik, Nikro Ish Adom. After Noach was called an Ish Tzadik, later on, before he plants the vine, he's called, or at the time of the planting of the vine, he's called an Ish Adom, a farmer, a man of the land. Ava Moshe Mish Nikro Ish Mitzri, Nikro Ish Elokim. But Moshe was first called Ish Mitzri. When the daughters of Yisroel referred to him to their father, they referred to him as an Ish Mitzri, as an Egyptian man. And Moshe is criticized by Chazal for having created the impression of being an Egyptian man. Although he needed to at that time, he was fleeing from Paro, you'll remember. And the obvious way to flee is to disguise yourself as one of the crowds. If he would have looked like Moshe Rabbeinu, they would have caught him immediately. And yet he's criticized for creating an impression which allowed the daughters of Yisroel to see him as an Egyptian. But nevertheless, later on he's called Ish HaElokim. So Rabbi Brechia doesn't see the difference between Noach and Moshe in the levels they finally attained, or the levels that they attained at their respective heights. The fact that Moshe attained a greater height than Noach, that's not what's important to Rabbi Brechia. What's important to Rabbi Brechia is the dynamics. Where are they going? The dynamics of the life of Noach is tragically from an Ish Tzadik to an Ish Adomo, from a Tzadik to a farmer, and the dynamics of Moshe's life is from an Ish Mitzri, from an Egyptian, to an Ish HaElokim. That's what's important. And what was responsible for those dynamics? We don't have time to go into that shiur all on its own, but the one aspect that needs to be noted here is when a person is referred to as an Ish Tzadik or an Ish HaAdomah, what does it mean, Ish HaAdomah, man of the land? That means that his mind became occupied with fixing up the land, which he can't really be blamed for. He comes out of the Teva and the world is desolate. The most urgent thing that needs attention is the reconstruction of the world around him. And the first thing he needs to do is the farming. There needs to be food. That's all in order, but he finds his mind totally occupied and preoccupied with being Mesakeh in the Olam, of fixing the world. That's often said, we are what we think. What our minds are occupied with, that defines who we really are. The Talmid Chacham is a person whose mind is occupied with learning, no matter what he's doing. What he's really thinking all the time, what he's really calculating and working out all the time is Torah, Halacha, that's what he's thinking. That's where his mind is preoccupied. A businessman is a man who is preoccupied with business. A lawyer is a man who is preoccupied with law. When we term a man, when we describe him by his profession, that means he is
entirely in that profession. He's immersed in that profession, in that activity. Isha Adomo. That's not said of Noach in praise. It's a fact. That's what he was. Isha Adomo. His mind was totally occupied with the agricultural reconstructing of the world. And that's Isha Adomo. He became preoccupied. His mind was with that. Ish Tzadik is a man whose mind is involved in righteousness. Ish HaElukim is a man whose mind is involved with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ish Mitzri is a man whose mind is involved in being like a Mitzri at that time. He was protecting his life. And there was, on Moshe's level, however, we're going to understand that there was just enough of a preoccupation with Egyptianism to be mistaken for an Egyptian himself, and for that he's criticized. When one becomes occupied and preoccupied with the needs of one's environment, one becomes affected by it. One begins to modify one's thinking, one's reasoning, one's activities to provide for that particular need. And it might be a worthy need, but that becomes everything. So you find, for example, I've always told you that doctors somehow see themselves as specially privileged people, which in some ways they are and in some ways they're not. For example, a doctor assumes that he's much busier than anybody else, which isn't true. He's got so many hours in a day and everybody else has got so many hours a day, and anybody who is devoted to his business or his profession puts in the maximum of hours that he can, and you'll find the top businessmen work 18 hours a day at their businesses, and the top lawyers work 18 hours a day at their law, and the top doctors work 18 hours a day at their medicine. They're not really more busy than anybody else. And sometimes somehow they feel that they're more entitled to mishiurim and so on, because after all they're doctors and medicine. It's a different field altogether. They're involved in something very spiritual, which isn't really so at all. What starts happening? They give themselves over to their profession. It becomes a sense of mission, which in a way it is. And their whole metzius, their whole being, is then adapted and molded into the needs of their profession. And they begin to think that way in terms of the needs of their patients, the needs of their hospital, the needs of their profession, and they modify their lives and their lifestyle to fit into the needs of their patients. Keeping Shabbos is hard to varying degrees for many different people. In business, in this country, it's become easier to keep Shabbos. It's more acceptable that business doesn't operate on Shabbos. But even where it's not that acceptable, and even where business does operate on Shabbos, a businessman knows, what can you do? Shabbos is Shabbos, you close up. And your business has to adapt to your Shabbos, because Shabbos is not going to adapt to your business. Perhaps one of the problems with the doctors is that the Torah does allow a certain amount of adaption of Shabbos to the circumstance. That already is the dangerous thing. The fact that the Torah allows it opens a Pesach for a doctor to think already that for him Shabbos is secondary. Shabbos must be adapted for the needs of the patient. That comes first. It's not so. Shabbos comes first. It is just that Shabbos has built into itself for the sake of Pikuach Nefesh because of the laws of Shabbos itself. Why are we allowed to be Mechalel Shabbos to save a person? Because that person, by being saved, is going to keep more Shabbosim. So the reason that you can be Mechalel Shabbos to save a life is not because the person is more important than Shabbos. The reason at the end of the day is because Shabbos is more important, and there will be more Shmira Shabbos if we save the person than if we don't. And that's how a doctor has to see it. He's doing it for Shabbos, he's not doing it for his profession. It's not that the Torah allows the concessions because his profession is so important. And the tendency is, whenever one begins to take one's activity very, very seriously, to adapt one's entire lifestyle and ultimately value system to that, and to see that as the ultimate. And that one has to be careful not to do. And when one's feedback comes from one's profession, when one's sense of dignity and pride comes from one's profession, when one's self-esteem comes from one's profession, more and more one finds oneself adapting one's thinking to those things which will bring forth positive feedback from one's environment. And the individual starts thinking differently, and he starts speaking differently, and he starts acting differently. The Rosh Yeshiva who was visiting us over Shabbos today told me that he despises fundraising. It's something which he finds very unpleasant. So he's a little bit envious. Some people come and they raise money, and they really enjoy it. They have a good time, and he suffers. And I said to him, as long as he suffers, he's okay. When he starts enjoying it, he's got to watch out. What begins to happen? Starts off, a Rosh Yeshiva starts off, his main job is to learn Torah. And his mind is in preparing his shiurim, in learning, in teaching. That's where his mind is. He has to raise money. That's a distraction. and he wants to get it over with as quickly as he can and get back to his primary function. And when he comes to a place to raise money, what is his thinking? What does he think when he sits down at a community? He doesn't look around and add up how much money is sitting around the table. He thinks to himself, what can I do to give some Torah to this community? What should I say? How should I teach them in a way that they'll get the most out of it? A different cheshbon. The moment he starts to enjoy his fundraising, then he looks around the table, he looks around the community, and he starts thinking to himself a different kind of thing. What should I say that will impress them in such a way that their response financially will be the best possible? And he justifies it. So that I can get back to my yeshiva and carry on my learning as quickly as possible. I must be most effective. But the fact is, his thinking starts changing and his reasoning starts changing because he becomes totally immersed in the needs of his environment in the sense in which he sees it. Let us take Noach.
Noach starts as an Ish Tzadik. What's an Ish Tzadik? We've been discussing this element of shame, this rashis.
To start with the purity of the Torah and to have the dynamics from the individual to the environment, not from the environment to the individual. To take the principles and the purity of Torah and impose them upon one's environment. It's an Ish Tzadik. What happened?
Circumstances demanded that
he become an Ish Adomo in a sense. He's got it. That's what he has to do. He has to now dedicate himself to the reconstruction of the world. But to become an Ish Adomo means that his calculations and his thinking and his reasoning is, what does the world need from me? Not what does the Ribbono Shel Olam want from me. What does the Torah want from me in this desolate world? How does the Ribbono Shel Olam want me to reconstruct this world? Had Noah thought that system through, he wouldn't have planted the vine first. He looks at the world and he finds himself calculating on the basis of the needs of the world. His profession now is, his most urgent profession is one to build the farm, is to plant and to reconstruct. And his total system of reasoning becomes determined by the needs of the world, not the desires of the Ribbono Shel Olam.
Moshe Rabbeinu, one would have expected a similar thing to happen. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was in the home of Paro, and he was learning Torah, he was taught Torah by his mother, and he was taught later on and carried on learning. There he was at a height. Then he becomes a refugee, and then he becomes a shepherd. One would think now he's gone into business, so his mind might be taken off Torah. And after that he becomes a king. Now his mind really becomes involved with politics and with leadership and with all the problems of communal leadership in the widest sense possible, to take Am Yisrael out of Mitzrayim, to create a nation out of them, to prepare them for Kabbalah Satorah, and then to prepare them for coming into Eretz Yisrael. One would expect that his mind became totally absorbed with the needs of his people, and he excelled in an understanding of the needs of his people. And he excelled in being able to think out the needs of his people. That was the gadlus of Moshe Rabbeinu, part of the gadlus of Moshe Rabbeinu. But that didn't change his value system in any way. He didn't become, in essence, a melech. He's never referred to as a melech. Moshe Rabbeinu is never referred to by his profession. Because his profession was never that which dictated his system of thinking and his value system. He becomes Isha Elohim, dictated to by one system only, and that is, what does the Ribbono Shel Olam want from me? The Ribbono Shel Olam has put me into the situation to invest into it, to build, to create perfection out of this imperfection. But his method of reasoning is not all the time, what is needed from me here? His system of reasoning is, here is an opportunity, here is a challenge, here is imperfection. The Torah is perfection. How do I apply the Ribbono Shel Olam's Torah onto this imperfection to create perfection out of it? What is the Ritzoyin Hashem? What does Hashem want from me in this particular situation? And so whereas Noah finds himself distracted from his tzidkus, his new responsibilities to become the leader of a new civilization, distract him from his own perfection, from his tzidkus, and make a farmer out of him, Moshe Rabbeinu's new responsibilities out of having been able to be a kolelite, just sitting and learning without any responsibilities, sitting in the house of Paro. He didn't have to work with the way Am Yisrael worked. He had everything laid on for him, everything provided for him. We would have thought that was the height of his career, and when he took on the responsibilities of leadership, of business, and of later on of leadership, we would have thought that would have begun his deterioration. Not so at all. Then he becomes Isha Elohim. Later on still, we see the growth and we see the development of Moshe Rabbeinu to the point where that very responsibility builds him bigger and bigger from the Ish Mitzri into the Isha Elohim. Here we see right the way through, in these three medroshim that we've briefly looked at, this concept of
the particular quality and nature of the Jew, of the Ben Torah, of the B'nai Shem as developed and expressed in reality by Avraham Avinu afterwards into our becoming the B'nai Yisrael, a people who are able to see perfection not in the environment, but to see the environment as a challenge that enables us to create perfection, that sees the environment as the raw material for the creation of perfection. And that in the creation of that perfection, our analysis of what constitutes that perfection is created not by our own personal visions of what could be, but of the vision of the Torah, and that our role is to take that vision of our vision of the Torah, of that perfection of the Torah, our understanding and analysis of the imperfections of the environment in which we find ourselves, to synthesize those two elements, to take that perfection of the Torah and the imperfection of the environment, to put them together in a way where we're able to create that totality of what is perfect in action, if not in object, where we're able to create actions of beauty, where we're able to create maisim, deeds, which are maisim shel mitzvah, which are deeds of mitzvahs, which have kedusha attached to them. Our ability to see in the tzitzis not only the physical form which has no real meaning, nor merely the concept which has no real meaning either, but to take that concept and to take the physical form, to put them together, and in that find all the 613 mitzvahs constituting the totality of Torah.